regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Telefarm conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled COVID-19 Labor and Employment Telefarm Series Number 2. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us G. Roger King, a Senior Labor and Employment Counsel at the HR Policy Association, and Tammy D. McCutcheon, a Principal at Littler Mendelson, PC. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. As a reminder, the audience members can see the presentations that our speakers will be following along with on FedSoc's website on this events page. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Mr. King, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning to all that have called in. I'm sheltering in place with my wife in Boise, Idaho. And I think, Tammy, you're in New York today?
I am.
So Tammy and I are going to go back and forth on our continuing series on COVID-19 labor and employment issues. We had our first segment a couple of weeks ago, had a great turnout, and even better turnout, as I understand it, on the follow-up podcast. And we do encourage your questions and comments. Tammy's going to lead us off today talking about Fair Labor Standards Act issues as they relate particularly to COVID-19, but also perhaps broader impact in the workplace. And besides Tammy being a principal at Littler Mendelson, she has a very active HR consulting practice. And before that was wage and hour head at USDOL. So she's got just a great background, one of the foremost experts in the country on Fair Labor Standards Act issues. So Tammy, let me turn it over to you.
Thank you, Roger. I'm blushing. So it goes.
That's all true. It's all true, Tammy. It's all true.
So it goes without saying that where, how, and what work we are performing today during the COVID-19 crisis has changed just vastly because of COVID-19 since really last March. Now, at Littler, we have literally answered thousands of questions from employers as they attempt to maintain compliance with the FLSA and similar state wage and hour laws, and especially because they have been forced to by local and state governments to shut down under these shutdown orders and that the inevitable economic impact that has resulted from that. They've been forced to do things that are not very pleasant for employees, like cutting pay, laying off employees, terminating employees, providing paid leave, new, of course, federal paid leave law for small employers, less than 500. And now, you know, if their businesses have survived, they're trying to get those employees back to work. And it's a difficult time and made more difficult because of these critical decisions businesses are having to make and because existing laws just never contemplated the situation that we're all faced with. And I think many employers may have had wage and hour compliance failures as they are struggling to keep their businesses alive because of this unique situation. So what I want to do today is issue spot for our listeners on the type of wage and hour issues and misses that I have seen over the last 4 months in three key areas: exemptions from overtime pay, failing to pay employees for all hours that they work, and failing to include all wages in the overtime calculations. Then I want to end by exploring the most important question of the day: can we turn to Congress or to the DOL for help as employers struggle to comply with the FLSA? So let me start out with the overtime exemptions. So each exemption for our rookies in the audience from the overtime pay requirements requires that employees be paid on a salary basis and that they perform certain job duties, a different job duty requirement for each of the exemptions. Now, because of the way work has changed, some exempt employees over the last 4 months may have fallen out of exemptions, may no longer be qualified for an exemption because of COVID-19. Now, first of all, it's because of the salary test, right? As employers are forced to cut pay across the board, the salary of some exempt employees may have dropped below the required minimums. Now, not just the federal required minimum salary of $684 per week, but California requires that exempt employees be paid $960 a week and $880 or higher in New York. So employers who have had to cut pay as revenues tanked due to government shutdowns could easily have just not thought about and not thought to ensure that the exempt employees continue to be paid that minimum required salary or to reclassify them as non-exempt and pay them by the hour if their hours are cut along with the cut in pay. So many employers also laid off or furloughed employees. But for these exempt employees, the FLSA requires that they be paid their full salary for any week in which they perform any work. And that's just 5 minutes of work. So if an exempt employee, and this is an employee not eligible for overtime, if that exempt employee spends 5 minutes looking at responding to emails at home during a furlough, bam, they're owed their full salary for that work. So any employee who's been on furlough who checked their emails, there could be a violation there. So what employers should have done, is, as I mentioned, to reclassify the exempt employees to non-exempt while they were on furlough and then just pay them an hourly rate for all time they actually spent working. And most likely, of course, no overtime pay would have been due anyway for these furloughed employees because they're not working over 40 hours a week. So reclassifying them to non-exempt wouldn't have been any additional labor cost. Okay, now let's talk about duties. Many exempt employees probably saw their duties change. Supervisors, in order to be an exempt supervisor, you have to supervise at least 2 full-time employees or 80 hours of other people's work under your supervision. So if supervisors saw their direct reports being furloughed or their hours being substantially reduced, then they did not continue to supervise that 80 hours of work each week. And therefore, the question arises, are they still supervisors? Are you still supervising employees who are on furlough? If forced by government shutdown orders to stay at home, are exempt outside sales employees still exempt? Right. To be exempt as an outside sales employee, you actually have to spend some time every week calling on your customers. So what if the government didn't let you out of your house? Did you ask as an employer, did you ask your exempt employees to take on more non-exempt work as the non-exempt employees had their hours cut or were furloughed? So to be exempt, employees must have what we call a primary duty of performing exempt work. But if exempt employees spent more than 50% of their time performing non-exempt work during the COVID crisis because non-exempt employees were furloughed, can they still qualify for any exemption? So the good news is, sort of, that there is a provision in the FLSA regulations. It's called 541.706, and I've reprinted it all in the PowerPoint that you can find posted on the at fedsoc.org. So there's this, and what this emergency provision says is that an exempt employee will not lose the exemption by performing non-exempt work because of the existence of an emergency that threatens the safety of employees, a cessation of operations, or serious damage to the employer's property. Now, most frequently, this provision is used to allow exempt employees to perform non-exempt work during a strike, right? So all your employees are out walking the picket line. There's nobody inside the manufacturing plant to run the lines. You can put an exempt worker on to do that non-exempt work without losing the exemption. So at Littler, our wage and hour experts have been debating for some weeks, months, on whether this emergency provision would apply to COVID-19, the changes for the work. And if it does apply, how long does an emergency last? Is it a month? Is it during the entire COVID crisis? But we really found no clear answer either in DOL guidance or in case law. But kudos to DOL. They actually did attempt to provide us an answer on this emergency provision last week with new FAQs that were posted on their website. This is just go to dol.gov/WHD for Wage Hour Division and click on their COVID page, and then you'll see some FAQs for the FLSA. And what you're looking for to see this is question number 16. And thank you. The answer we got from the DOL is yes, COVID-19 is an emergency under this regulatory section, and thus temporary employees can be, quote, temporarily required to perform non-exempt duties due to COVID-19 without losing the exemption. All right. Is that the answer? Well, I think the FAQ is not complete protection for employers. It's still a bit fuzzy on three key points. One, what is temporary, right? Does that mean that exempt employees can perform non-exempt work until the crisis ends everywhere in the country? Or does it end when the state or local government allows us to go back to business as usual? The other thing is the FAQ says they can perform non-exempt work when that is caused by and due to COVID. So what is the employer, what if an employer, so what does that mean, due to COVID? Litigation incoming. What if an employer decides to lay off all non-exempt employees and then have the exempt perform their work, right? They decide to move all the work that they do have to the exempt and lay off all the non-exempts. Is that due to COVID? You know, or is that an employer choice that they chose to cut the non-exempts rather than cut the exempts? Finally, weirdly and interestingly, the question in the FAQ that DOL says they're answering refers only to executive, administrative, and professional employees. The outside sales exemption is not in the question, even though that regulatory section applies, it's in the part 700 of the regulations, and that is a definitional section that applies to every exemption, but it's not in the FAQ question. So what about those exempt outside sales employees that have been prohibited by governments from actually going outside to visit clients? Does the FAQ apply to them? You know, to me, this is the biggest issue that I've been talking about that my clients are concerned about, is whether or not outside salesmen can still be exempt if they can't go outside. So the question is, why did DOL fail to put outside sales, list that in the question that they were answering? Was that purposeful or was it unintentional? So also remember, of course, many states are not going to have a similar emergency provision, and thus there are no help here for state law claims. You know, can we see, say, California PAGA three times fast, right? So you still have some areas of vulnerability under state law. Nonetheless, the FAQ is something better than nothing. And my advice is to try to rely on this provision as little as an employer can, and be sure to document why changes in job duties that were actually caused by COVID, that there is some protection here. All right, I want to move now on to talk about your non-exempt overtime eligible employees. Now, ensuring that employees are paid for all compensable work activities has always been a challenge. What is work? Seems like it should be a simple question, but there are thousands and thousands and thousands of case law on whether a particular activity is work or not. So with more non-exempt employees working from home during the COVID crisis, you know, off-the-clock work has become even more of a problem and more of a challenge to comply. How are employees tracking time of non-exempt employees who are working from home? Did they create any new procedures or controls to ensure that employees are reporting all of their hours and that they're actually working those hours? Perhaps for me, the biggest issue, more importantly, as we return to work, there are new questions regarding what COVID-19 activities actually must be paid. So questions that I'm getting, we want to require our non-exempt employees on an unpaid furlough to check in and tell us whether or not they're willing to come back to work and to check in to see if we do have work for them, then we have to pay for that. A lot of employers now, of course, are requiring their employees to wear masks at work and other personal protective equipment? Do you have to pay for that time? Temperature checks and health screens. A lot of governments now are going to, when people reopen offices, they're going to require the employers to make their employees do temperature checks and health screenings. And what about all that extra time it's going to take us to commute into work, right? A lot of buildings are requiring a very, very limited number of people in an elevator. So there's going to be long line at elevators. There's going to be less capacity in our public transportation. So do we have to pay for that extra time? Let me give you my view of these answers. On check-ins to require your furlough employees to check in to see if they want to work, I think the answer to that is totally unclear. Probably yes, that employees must be paid for putting on required masks and other personal protective equipment. I hear you. You're saying, but it's only a couple of seconds. Well, guess what? Last year, the California Supreme Court said there's no such thing as de minimis time. You got to pay for every second. And DOL's position is that to be de minimis and thus not, you don't have to pay an employee for the activity, it has to be both small in time and an activity that that occurs sporadically and infrequently, right? So DOL's position is if you know that they're going to take 5 seconds to put on their mask every day they're at work, then you got to pay for that time. It depends on the temperature checks and health screening. Totally depends on the state law you're in. Under federal law, there was a case a couple of years ago about checking bags for security and contraband at Amazon warehouses, and the Supreme Court said nope. That's a preliminary activity that you don't have to pay for. So I think federally, you don't have to pay if you require employers to do temperature checks or health screenings. But in California, you betcha you're going to have to pay for that. And there's a good handful of other states where you are going to have to pay for that time. And if that is work time, you get all sorts of other questions. Okay, if you require them to do their temperature checks at home, does that mean that starts the time clock and now they've got to be paid for their commute that happens after they take their temperatures? And then in states like New York and California that have these reporting time pay requirements, in California, if an employee starts work, you got to pay them for at least 4 hours, right? So somebody takes their temperature, the temperature is too high, you tell them you can't come to work. Yes, in California, you're going to probably have to pay them 4 hours for spending the 3 minutes to check their temperature. And probably no for our extra commuting time. Commuting time is generally not compensable work. It's considered just part of what everybody does to get into work. So additional time it takes you to commute, including waiting in line for the elevator, is not exempt. All right. Overtime pay calculations. Employers, sorry about this call coming in, distracted me. Okay. Overtime pay calculations. A lot of employers are doing great things for their non-exempt employees, like paying them hazard pay when they're an essential worker and they have to go into work. And because of the $600 federal unemployment bonus we get for not working, a lot of employers are finding it hard now to get their employees back to work. Now, that, of course, that unemployment federal $600 benefit ends tomorrow, but it looks like there is going to be some sort of different or additional unemployment support. But employers are actually paying people bonuses if they agree to come back to work. Whether it's hazard pay or a bonus, a hardship bonus, return to work bonus, you have to pay overtime on those bonuses, right? Because they're part of the employee's wages. So you are going to be paying, and what you do is you take a bonus, you divide it by the number of hours worked during the week times 0.5 times the overtime hours worked in the week. So you can owe extra overtime. Most people don't know about that requirement, and so I have a feeling there's going to be some mistakes being made. So in case you're wondering, there are a lot of plaintiffs out there who just do not care that companies are struggling to stay afloat, especially in restaurant, retail, and hospitality. So we are already seeing COVID-19 related lawsuits being filed and expect more. The Cook County jail officers sued, for example, for the time that they were spending to an additional sanitation and dunning and doffing without getting paid. All total, we tracked this at Littler, There have been over 400 COVID-related lawsuits that have been filed since mid-March, alleging everything from wage and hour to safety to discrimination. The top states for these COVID lawsuits are California, Florida, New Jersey, and New York. So before I let go of the mic and hand this boat back over to Roger, can Congress help? Can DOL help? Well, Congress is trying, right? You might have read a little bit about the Senate, the next relief bill. The Senate version does include a liability shield, but I think there's and it's clear that that liability shield is to protect employers from accusations that that employees have COVID-19 because of activities or inactivities by their employers. Less clear whether or not this liability shield is going to be protecting employers who, you know, fail to pay an employee for time spent donning and doffing, right? So how much of the liability shield is going to be actually liability from FLSA violations? For example, all those outside sales employees who are no longer qualified as outside sales employees. I'm watching this closely. We haven't actually seen bill text yet. Although if you go to littler.com, you can find a summary of what we have heard from the Senate Republicans on this shield. But I think that FLSA is going to be left behind by the Senate. If the Senate Republicans have their way and actually do pass a liability shield, I very, very much doubt it's going to relieve employers from liability for FLSA violations. Finally, can DOL help? Don't have time to go through this in detail, but it's in the PowerPoint that I posted on the fedsoc.org. I know. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help. Believe it or not, DOL, obviously we need more FAQs, more opinion letters, more guidance for employers on these types of issues. But they also have what's called the PAID program, which the Trump administration officials at DOL started a couple of years ago. And what this is if you realize you've done something wrong, oops, you can take your oops to the DOL, tell them about it, tell them how much you think you owe the employees, and they will help you get those back wages back to the employees. Now, why the heck would you want to do that? Well, because you're going to pay 100% of 2 years of back wages, but you are not going to pay the third year of back wages, liquidated damages that are equal to the amount of back wages you pay, civil money penalties of up to $2,000 per employee. And of course, you're going to get a waiver for any employee who accepts the back wages. They waive their right to sue. So you're saving, you know, just in back wages, liquidated damages, and civil money penalties, that's a 66% savings, let alone not having to face private lawsuits or pay those plaintiff's attorney's fees. So two other reasons that I encourage participation is, of course, the waiver. And then during this process, DOL will give their approval to you on how you're paying your employees, which is basically a good faith defense, right? So there's no way plaintiff's lawyer is going to be able to get more money when DOL has said you're doing the right thing. So the PAID website, in case you're interested, dol.gov/agencies/WHD/PAID. And Roger, I think I'm done.
Well, not yet. I'm not going to let you off that easy. but before I have some questions and some thoughts to share, and like your reaction. Greg, do we have questions for Tammy? Any in the queue?
Let's go to audience question. I also encourage callers to follow along with Tammy and Roger's link presentations on the Teleforum's event page at fedsoc.org.
Thanks, Greg.
Roger, it doesn't look like we have any questions off the bat. Do you want to ask some of yours?
Well, yes, I do. And Tammy, great presentation. A lot of ground covered in a very short period of time. I want to emphasize something that Tammy mentioned, and that's the Littler Mendelson website tracking COVID-19 labor and employment litigation around the country. Tammy, that's, I think, updated weekly and quite comprehensive, right?
Yep, it is. It is. And our COVID page, by the way, actually also tracks every single government shutdown and closure order. Right. And so you can go there, click on, backslash COVID, and you'll find all of that.
That's great stuff. It's one of the best resources, I think, that's out there on ongoing developments and also COVID-19, labor employment litigation. Tammy, what do you think the potential is for further guidance from DOL, more FAQs, more helpful thoughts from the government?
Well, I think the Administrator Stanton wants to do more, but just as when I was there back in the Bush administration, even to put out one FAQ requires like 10 people to approve it, right? And so guidance has been slow in coming, and I think it will, and they're focusing on so many other issues, right? They have the new paid sick leave law, right, to do FAQs on. Now they're getting, DOL is also, of course, getting under criticism about how the states are implementing the extra unemployment benefit and stuff. So there's just so much going on at DOL that answering these types of very specific questions, I'm hopeful, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Right. Understood. Yeah, tremendous amount of work on DOL. A lot more than I think most people realize. Tammy, you've touched upon the duties test as we're talking about exempt employees. Could you comment just a bit further, particularly as it relates to the California duties test? I think a lot of employers just don't have a good understanding of the duties requirements.
The problem is that the duties requirements are in a legislative regulation, right, rather than an interpretive regulation. If it was an interpretive regulation, DOL could just come in and grant an exceptions, anything like that. But because these are legislative regulations that DOL was told by Congress to do, they can't change the regulations without another regulatory process. And we all know that's like a minimum 1 year if you're going super fast, normally 2 to 3. They could, and they have the power to, and they do have non-enforcement policies where they say, you know what, we're not going to, if you don't pay somebody for donning a mask, we're not going to enforce against that. But that does nothing for the private lawsuits, right? So it's the private lawsuits that I'm worried about, not the current administration enforcing the FLSA in an unfair way, given the current crisis. But you know these plaintiff's lawyers, right? They'll sue for anything, and they don't care if your company is on the edge of bankruptcy.
Right, and the duties test in California is particularly difficult. For our HR policy members, you want to comment just briefly on California and the duties test?
Yeah, California, the biggest difference is this. Let's take outside sales. For outside sales, under the federal law, you have to customarily and regularly make sales away from any fixed place of business or your home. And there's a DOL opinion letter that says 1 or 2 hours a day, 1 or 2 days a week, that's enough. In California, you have to be away from any fixed place of doing business a hard over 50% of the time, right? And then, of course, the worst thing about that is a violation in California costs so much because of the Private Attorney General's Act, right? And so it's $250 per violation. That's not much. But a violation is every day for every employee. So these PAGA penalties just like, boom, they explode and they're the biggest part of it. So not only are the requirements more difficult to meet than the federal government, but the penalties are massive.
Right. And penalties a problem. That 50% plus test can be very challenging for sure. With respect to exempt employees, and I thought your comment was just spot on. If an exempt employee just does 5 minutes of emails at home while she or he is on furlough, you have triggered the salary requirement for that week. What about telling a furloughed employee, we don't need you at all this week, so we are going to not pay you in 1 week increments, okay?
Right. Yep, it's in 1 week increments, right? So if they do indeed do nothing at all during a work week, then they do not have to pay anything. And so for our perspective, at Litla, the best practice is if you put an exempt salaried employee out on furlough, you actually give them a written document and says, do not work.
Yes.
You are not required to work. Do not work. I think it's actually safer since there's not going to be any overtime pay due in this situation, just to reclassify them as non-exempt during their quote-unquote furlough, and if require them to report any work that they do, including checking up emails or telephone calls, and pay them for that time. You know, take their salary, divide it by 40, and that's their hourly rate, and pay them for that time. And don't worry, Roger, because as soon as things go back to normal, you know, they're back in the office, they're off of furlough, they're resuming their normal job duties, they can be reclassified back to exempt with no problem.
Right. No, that's great counsel. Well, what about one-day increments? I know there's a wage and hour reg that if I voluntarily say, okay, I'm exempt, I won't work at all this day, you don't have to pay me. Okay?
Yep. And that is, you know, I can tell you where it's 29 CFR 541.602. And unfortunately, the only sort of one-day or partial-day increments that where you cannot pay an employee is if they're out sick, right, and you have salary replacement benefits, or if it's that they take a personal day. And this is because this absence of the furlough is required by the needs of the business and is not something that the employee wants to take the day off. You cannot dock for a single day or a half a day. You have to pay the full salary if they perform work, any work during the week.
Right. So it's back to this, maybe better to reclassify for a short period of time. I think that's just excellent. Counsel, I want to ask you just a few questions about the de minimis exception. I know, based on my own private practice background, that sporadic, episodic, albeit de minimis not defined, perhaps gets you in the discussion. Do you think COVID-19 makes any difference here on interpreting and applying the de minimis rule?
Right. Wouldn't that be great if DOL would issue us some guidance on that? Right. It would be wonderful. Now, their guidance where they basically said, you know, it's a long standing, but this is a special situation. So it would be great if they could issue guidance on that, especially because if you look at the case law, not all federal circuits and courts follow this. You can find a lot of case law decisions where as long as it's just if it's 30 seconds, a minute, regardless of whether it's regular or not, that the courts will say it's de minimis, you don't have to pay for it. But again, you know, California rears its head because there is no such thing as de minimis under California law as of last year.
Right. Well, maybe we'll get something on de minimis. Stay tuned. Wouldn't that be great? Hey, start of the workday. I know we've been discouraging our members to have employees perform medical checks, temperature checks, what have you, fill out health questionnaires, or do something along those lines at their home before they report to work because of the potential fear of the start of the workday. Would you just expand on that just a moment? Sure. When does one's workday really start under the FLSA?
Well, it starts when you do the first activity that you do that's required and is part of your job. It does not start if you do a post-liminary or preliminary activity. And that's that Supreme Court case that found that, for example, checking somebody's bags to make sure they're not stealing any product in the Amazon warehouse. That's not a principal activity. That's a post-liminary, so you don't have to pay for it. However, of course, California has come out the other way. There have been some unsuccessful lawsuits before COVID for employees who were like HVAC workers who went from maintenance workers who didn't have a fixed work location but went from like store to store to store. And the question was if they're at home and they check their emails to see where their first assignment is. Does that start the workday? And those mostly have failed, but the lawsuits have been brought. And as you know, since the lawsuits have been brought, that's what, $500,000 for the employer to get out of. So it's something that we're the same. I mean, I'd rather have them do it at work. It doesn't help in New York and California when you have those reporting time pay requirements. Right. The other thing too, just wanted to mention here for your information. So my other employer, Compliance HR, compliancehr.com is the website where we write employment compliance apps. We have a brand new app out where you can put out on an enterprise basis, and the employee goes on their smartphone, they answer health screening questions that are required by the state or local government, and then it tells them very quickly whether they can come into work or not. It takes only about 15 seconds to do it, and then you have actually, not only do you have, you know, documentation that they cleared the health screening test, but you have the amount of time they spent, which is one solution that we've developed for low and compliance HR. But it can't, if it starts the workday, you're paying for the entire commute time, right?
And yeah, you know, big time problem, right? Problem. No, that app sounds great. I think something that everybody on the call really ought to look at. With respect to starting the workday, let's say, Tammy, I'm a non-exempt hourly worker. I'm working from home. And I log in, get my computer started in the morning. Then I go make breakfast for the kids. Then I come back to my computer, do a little more work. And then I go outside to do a few chores and I come back in. Has my workday started when I logged in? What about people working at home? How do you track those hours for hourly non-exempt?
Well, unless you can track their computer usage, which is, you know, probably not that accurate anyway, it's tough, right? You're on a system. And there is now people like to talk about with the FLSA is you have to be paid whistle to whistle, right? From the start of your workday to the end of the workday. But it's not absolute, right? So, for example, under most FLSA, most state laws, you do not have to pay employees for taking lunch breaks, right? You can have unpaid lunch breaks of at least 30 minutes. And so my opinion on this one is, you know, you do not have to pay them when they make those types of breaks. Now, here's the thing. Take that 30 minutes. Breaks under 20 minutes have to be paid. Breaks over 30 minutes don't have to be paid, and that's what I would use, right? So, unfortunately, if mom goes away to quiet a crying baby and it takes her 10 minutes, you just have to pay for that time, right? But if she's going out, right, you know, and spending a half an hour more to do stuff around the house, you don't have to pay for that time. But how do you know? So, which makes it very difficult. That's why telecommute, you know, a lot of people are talking about, oh, COVID-19, we can all telecommute now, you know, is changing. But the problem is, how do you know how much you have to pay your employees? And there's a lot of businesses that can't afford to pay somebody for 8 hours of work if they only worked two. Right.
Well, I mean, and that's spot on, Tammy. I mean, as we move toward the school year in many, many parts of the country in August, and we have working moms and dads having to stay home, work from home, but yet also homeschool or at least monitor on a tele-education basis their children's education. How do you track hours accurately? And are we going to get differences of opinion, at least from the plaintiff's bar? It's going to be a challenge, right?
It's going to be a challenge. There's going to be lots of litigation coming down the road. I think primarily the litigation we're seeing today is more safety and health related. I think the FLSA lawsuits and the California class actions are going to be coming in huge, big numbers coming forward. And I think the only way, you know, you're not going to be able to track hours worked accurately, you know, I don't see any solution except for accepting what the employee tells you they worked. So you're going to have to be, it means more management as you assess the quality and quantity of the work that they're completing in the time that they say they're working, right? So, and I think that's where the discipline and termination will have to come in. If somebody says, oh yeah, I worked 10 hours today, and you look at the work they performed and it's like, oh, you could have done that in half an hour. I think that's how you're going to have to manage these non-exempt employees.
Well, let's just close out, and I totally agree. So what about the time period for potential liability, just the statute of limitations, at least under the federal law? How long should employers be concerned?
Well, this is a good thing, right? Because the statute of limitations under federal law is 2 years, 3 years if you have acted willfully. And I think we could all say there's not going to be any willfulness findings. Some states have longer statute of limitations, 6 years in New York, 4 years in California. But this is why the paid program is so important, right? Because you can limit your liability just to that 2 years. And because we're talking about like the last 4 to 6 months that these problems might have occurred. Even in states like California and New York that have longer statute of limitations, you can correct what you're doing going forward and get all of the liability paid for the 4 months, the 6 months through the Department of Labor and get these waivers of claims. You cannot, FLSA, there's no private settlements of FLSA like discrimination cases, right? The only way an employee can waive claims is through a court settlement or a DOL settlement. And that's why the paid program is so important and so useful at this time for our clients that have made a mistake. They had no, struggling to survive, no concept that they made a mistake. You can go in, get it corrected, pay back wages for 4 to 6 months, get your waivers, and you're done.
We have a caller with a question if you guys are ready to field one.
No, please, Greg, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks very much for the very enlightening discussion. I'm just curious, I realize this fall's election will probably be the most significant factor in it, but I'm wondering what your opinions are about the prospect of COVID-19 being the impetus for dragging the FLSA into the information age from the industrial age and getting away from the lunacy of hourly compensation as opposed to something more meaningful like piecework.
I think it's going to the election will have an enormous impact. You forget during the Obama administration, they refused even to answer questions from employers about what the FLSA requires, right? That's called an opinion letter. And it was only with the Trump administration coming in, which they actually started issuing opinion letters. And also the whole paid program. Yeah, the Obama administration, no way would they do that. And many state attorneys general actually criticized the Department of Labor from trying to help employers to get it right. Because, of course, it's unfair that they only have to pay 2 years of back wages. You're letting them get away with not paying 3 years and then double damages. So it will have a huge impact. And this administration has done something. So it's sort of a myth that if you're overtime eligible, you have to be paid by the hour. That's not true. You can be paid on a piece rate. You can be paid 100% commission. You can even be paid a salary. Now, you still have to calculate and pay overtime on whatever compensation that you pay the employee in whatever form for hours worked over 40. And this administration has actually helped. They have done regulations called the regular rate regulations that clarify what types of compensation have to be included in that overtime calculation. And most recently, they've clarified how to pay and calculate overtime for non-exempt employees paid on a salary. And I think that has helped employers a lot so that they can look to alternative ways like piece rate, day rate, commissions, and salary to pay non-exempt employees. And I think that if the Democrats came back into the Department of Labor, that would all stop.
The question's an excellent one. The election's going to potentially result in a major change in labor law in this country. We can debate whether that's good or bad. It depends on your perspective. But certainly big impact, and many people, of course, don't think about what we're talking about today, rules and regulations, Fair Labor Standards Act, other federal statutes, significant impact by election results. Greg, do we have any other questions in the queue for Tammy and Fair Labor Standards Act? All right. Well, please feel free to submit a question. Let me now turn to the National Labor Relations Act. My slides, like Tammy's, are on the Federal Society webpage, and I'm going to be following them as I make my remarks. I, in all probability, will not go through all of my slides today. Tammy and I continue this three-part series on August 5th, and there will be an announcement of that to the Federal Society website. So we will certainly complete the material, and then per our outline that we put together for this entire three-part series, we will move to other subjects as we conclude on the third part of the series on August 5. So I'm with my slides, if you're following. So I'm on slide one, and what I want to do here is set the stage about what kind of activity that employees engage in, whether it be at the workplace or away from the workplace, is protected from employer discipline, including potential termination. And the reason I want to set the stage in that manner is that we have social justice protests, we have safety strikes, we have safety walkouts, we have a great deal of worker unrest in this country. It's evident from picking up any newspaper or listening to any newscast, a lot of agitation in the workplace, perhaps justifiable in certain circumstances. So this, the bedrock of this protection, if it's available, would be the National Labor Relations Act, and particularly as you see on slide one, section seven. If you go to the bottom of section seven, mutual aid or protection. And essentially, the Supreme Court and other federal courts and the LRB have interpreted section seven very broadly. So if two or more employees come together for their mutual aid and protection and have an issue, a dispute, a concern regarding terms and conditions, employment, or enforcement of their collective bargaining agreement, those employees are in a protected zone. They're engaged in protected activity, protected concerted activity. Now, I want to stop there just for a moment. For those of that might not be familiar with the National Labor Relations Act, this statute applies to the private sector, employers in the country, except for rail and air. The NRA does not apply to governmental workers. So do keep that in mind. But obviously, the reach and scope of the NRA is quite broad. So as you see at the bottom of the first slide, generally, there must be some type of link between the activity in question and the employee's terms and conditions of employment. So let's go to the next slide. So more specifically, under the NRA, the National Labor Relations Board has extended protection to concerted political activity on certain cases if that activity can be connected or has a nexus with the interest of employees and their terms and conditions of employment. And we're going to come back to that in a moment, because this discussion of nexus and connection is particularly important when we talk about social justice strikes, social justice walkouts, and other, at least arguably, political activity. And as you see in the last bullet on the slide two, the NRA, therefore, has been deemed by many to be sort of the bedrock, if you will, of the free speech in the workplace discussion. All right. Let's move to the next slide, and it's slide three. What about potential disruptions in the workplace? Well, let's start with safety-related walkouts and strikes. As we all know, COVID-19 has brought about all kinds of safety issues for workers and third parties, customers, clients that come in contact with workers, and what is going to be the proper protection in the workplace. Whether it be PPE situations, social distancing situations, whether we have appropriate ventilation, et cetera, just a whole host of safety-related issues are cropping up, and correctly so. For non-represented, non-union employees, again, I go back to Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, and the right to refuse to work in conditions that these employees believe to be unsafe. So what's the standard? It appears from the case law to be quite low, even potentially a subjective, non-evidence-based concern that we don't have proper ventilation. These are not the right masks. We have too many people congregating in the lunchroom area, et cetera. Should there be a higher standard? Should there be some reasonable good faith standard? That's a potential litigation point. Watch that. But I would stress to our audience, for non-unionized workers, be very careful, because many courts would, and even the NLRB, really permit a very wide range of protection if safety issues are raised. And can you replace temporarily or permanently employees that are engaging in a work stoppage or walkout on safety issues? Well, certainly, perhaps temporarily, you continue your operations. You can't terminate them because this is a protected concerted activity. So again, I would be very careful about that, what you're going to do on a short range and long range action plan should be reviewed with counsel for sure. Well, let's keep moving through the slides. Let's go to the next slide. What about unionized represented employees? Well, Section 502 of the Labor Management Relations Act does come into play here. And refusals to work over unsafe conditions are not considered strikes, and that's a very important distinction. If it were an economic strike, put aside the safety issue, and workers were striking, refusing to work because they believe they're not being paid appropriately, whether it be union or non-union, that's protected considered activity, but that's an economic strike. And a worker, whether he or she is represented or not, has a right to refuse to work, withhold their labor, if you will. But the employer in an economic strike can not only temporarily replace those workers, but also could permanently replace them, not terminate them, a very important distinction, but could be permanently replacing them, subject to the strikers only having a right to return to work when and if their positions become available again. However, and this is important, however, in a safety situation, the employer would be prohibited from replacing the safety striking workers. Here we do have a higher standard, a quote, ascertainable objective evidence standard that creates abnormally dangerous conditions for work, as you see on this slide. That's a standard that is applicable under Section 502. And this could be done on an individual basis, doesn't require two or more workers to trigger this protection. And again, as I mentioned, no termination of workers that engage in this area. And even if the employer and its union contract, and I'd say virtually every contract I've ever seen has a no-strike clause in it, the no-strike clause may not be applicable here. In fact, it's probably not going to be applicable in the safety area. So employers should not just say, well, we've got a no-strike clause, you can't do what you're doing. That is not going to win the day in most instances. All right, let's go to our next slide. So what about the issue of social justice strikes? I mean, where are we going to go in this country with respect to employees saying, I think X, I think Y, things are wrong, and I'm going to walk out. I'm not going to perform work because I have a strong belief regarding X, whatever X may be. And we certainly are seeing some very concerned workers, and perhaps with great justification, raising these issues with substantial union support. So does the National Labor Relations Act protect that kind of activity? As you see on slide six, there must be some nexus between the walkout or strike and the workers' terms and conditions of employment. And we have virtually no case law or guidance in this area. The most analogous situation in all probability is the 2017 Day Without Immigrants protest and related activities. And there, a question was posed to the National Labor Relations Board Office of Legal Counsel, the chief lawyer, if you will, for the National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB members at that time did not vote on any case. This is just guidance from the legal office of the board, if you will. And a question was posed as to whether a worker leaving her or his workstation to go to an immigration protest was engaged in protected activity and could not be terminated. And the Associate General Counsel of the Board at the time concluded there was a sufficient nexus between issues that were being raised by the immigration protests. You may recall immigration raids, INS raids on employers' places of business, deportation of workers without appropriate credentials, and authorization to work. So the Board General Counsel, its lawyer's office, if you will, found in that circumstance there was a sufficient nexus, again, between the protest, the walkout, the dispute, and terms and conditions of employment. Going back to some of the recent social justice movements, the 8-minute Floyd remembrance, on the 20th of July and other related walkouts. The unions that were sponsoring those activities were careful to put in the mix Fight for $15 minimum wage issues, but were careful to put in a mix of discussion, safety issues, safety in the workplace. So I believe in all probability, at least if I were writing a memo on this issue for a client, I would have to conclude that probably was sufficient nexus or justification for the work stoppage and the activity would be protected. Now, all that said, workers under any situation don't have a right to put the employer's operation in jeopardy, whether it be a power plant, nurses in an operating room. There is some common sense that comes into play here. But my message to employers in this area is be careful before you take discipline if there is a social justice issue being raised. Greg, let me stop there. Maybe a good stopping point for this segment of our series of COVID-19 labor and employment. Do we have any questions or comments?
We don't have any questions.
I actually have one that I've been contemplating for a long time, and I love to ask a NLRB traditional labor person like you. We've been hearing a lot about efforts to organize, ask for more wages at employers during COVID-19. In particular, we've been reading a lot about Amazon employees, you know, striking, demanding this and that. With the high unemployment, like some 40 million people still out of work, is unionizing really going to be successful when there's so many people willing to step in? And I'll raise my hand for the $15 an hour that Amazon is paying if you don't want to work there. So I'd love to hear your views on unionization in the COVID aid. Is it being successful, or is it like a really bad time for employees with jobs to complain about wages and conditions?
Interesting question, a lot of discussion. Some in the union movement believe that they are in a golden age of organizing because they can raise safety-related issues in the workplace. They can raise social justice issues, Fight for 15 issues in the workplace, and that workers will be very sensitized to that and decide to join a union. To date, that really has not happened. And Tammy, our unionization rate in the private sector this country still is low single digits, depending on how you count unionized workers and non-governmental positions, 6-7% range. Haven't seen a significant spike in petitions for an election. And I think, per your point, when I'm not secure in my job, I'm not sure I have a job, and or I'm laid off looking for work, and or I have concerns about my son and daughter getting an appropriate education and how do we work from home. There's so many other issues that are facing all of us in this country that union representation may not be at the forefront. But that said, some union leaders are working very hard, Service Employees International Union, particularly National Nurses United in the healthcare space. So I think the answer to your question remains to be seen. Everybody in this country, I think, in the spring of this year said, well, this is novel. This can't last. Let's all get through it and everything will be fine. Well, as we approach the fall, and particularly the school issue and everything else on the table, we're not so sure. And whether the union movement can capitalize on this uncertain times, check back. Let's talk about that maybe next spring, Tammy. Greg, do we have it? Yes, we will. Greg, any other questions or comments from our audience?
We do not. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. I'd like to remind callers the third installment of this Teleform series will be next week on August 5th. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.